Welcome to the 73 Dream Studios Variety Show. One, it's me, Ray. Today, on Grappling with Ray, I'm talking the WWE Draft, the TBS title, Knockouts Knockdown, and much more. First up, who do I think came out on top in the WWE Draft? Before I get into the analysis of who got the better picks, I'm going to say right now, I don't like how they have done the draft the past few years, where each show is given picks and to guarantee they keep someone they already have in their roster, they simply use a draft pick on them. This system worked once, and that was when they rebooted the brand split in 2016, but now when rosters are already established, we don't really need to waste the TV time and the suspense on the announcement that a pick was used to retain a performer that was already on the roster. I enjoyed the era of the draft where picks were earned with matches, and said picks were done at random as a lottery. There was constant suspense in the air, and every single match of the show meant something. Unlike in this last draft, where it seemed we simply had afterthought matches to make the live crowd content. I understand they were trying to make it more similar to the NFL draft and that they are also appealing to the idea that Fox and NBC executives are in competition by trying to snag the top stars for their own networks. As far as the NFL comparisons, the only way a draft makes sense in that regard is to give Raw and SmackDown picks and allow them to pull from any of the developmental brands such as NXT, NXT UK, or 205 Live. Imagine the excitement of having one or two rounds exclusively for calling up the young stars of tomorrow. And while there is no easy answer for the XX, in an ideal world, they would allow WWE to perform the draft and withhold their judgment until after seeing the results. But I'm not in the room where it happens, so I can only imagine that this is far from the case. This is all very much an opinion, as I'm sure there are plenty out there who think differently. What do you guys think? Would you like to see this style of draft continue? Do you want a return to the drafts of 2007 to 2011 like I do? Or do you want something different? Let me know on our socials or in a message sent through anchor.fm. But as for how the draft turned out, let me focus on the people who actually switched brands. Going from SmackDown to Raw, we have Big E, Bianca Belair, Edge, Rey and Dominic Mysterio, Austin Theory, Alpha Academy, Apollo Crews and Commander Aziz, Zelina Vega, Becky Lynch, Seth Rollins, Kevin Owens, The Street Profits, Finn Balor, Carmella, Gable Stevenson, The Dirty Dogs, Liv Morgan, Mia Yim, Tamina, and Tegan Nox. Going from Raw to SmackDown, we have Charlotte Flair, Drew McIntyre, The New Day, Hit Row, Jeff Hardy, Aaliyah, Drew Gulak, Mace, Mansoor, Mustafa Ali, Sheamus, Shayna Baszler, Xia Li, The Viking Raiders, Ricochet, Angel Garza and Humberto Carrillo, Ridge Holland, Jinder Mahal, and Shanky. Raw received only two more extra talents than SmackDown pick-wise, though SmackDown noticeably bolstered its tag team division, having drafted Hit Row from NXT and also receiving The New Day, that being Kofi Kingston and Xavier Woods of The New Day, The Viking Raiders, Garza and Carrillo, Mahal and Shanky, and Ali and Mansoor. In return, Raw received Rey and Dominic, a tag team that has been teasing a breakup, Alpha Academy, a heel team that's received lackluster booking, Apollo Crews and Commander Aziz, a single star with a bodyguard, The Dirty Dogs, another team that has been criminally underused as of late, and The Street Profits, which, if you believe the rumors, are another team that is potentially splitting, and almost split, in the draft, as many other teams did. Raw's tag team division was slim pickings despite the immense talent that it had, and most of that went to SmackDown. In months' time, we could see broken teams and a program between Alpha Academy and the Dirty Dogs going far too long. One spot Raw did improve was their women's division. While SmackDown used their picks wisely, snatching immense star power in Charlotte Flair, sheer brutality in Shayna Baszler, and potential with NXT call-ups such as Aaliyah, Xia Li, and B-Fab Hit Row, Raw needed to create more potential matchups, so they went for quantity. While I'm sad to see Tegan Nox and Shotzi Blackheart, as well as Tamina and Natalya, broken up in the draft, seriously, how many tag teams are there even in the women's tag team division now? I'm excited to see what each one of these women brings in Solo's careers. Mia Yim returns, but without the mask, instead carrying her true-to-life Blazing baddie persona. This gimmick carried her to great matches in NXT, where she was able to shine. Assuming she can be given the screen time that's hotly contested for, Mia will do great on Monday Night Raw. Liv Morgan and Zelina Vega have had the hottest streaks in their careers while on Monday nights, as they each have strong personas and mic skills that fit right in with the vibe that Raw carries with its dramatic storylines. And of course, we can't forget that Raw now has both the EST and the Man on the Red brand. So, SmackDown won on tag teams, Raw won with women. But what about men's singles division? This was a hard one. I'm going to have to give a very slight edge to Raw. SmackDown has potential. They have Drew McIntyre, who can run a program with Roman Reigns no problem, as can Sheamus. They have fresh young stars like Isaiah Swerve Scott, and let's face it, he's probably only going to be known as Swerve once he actually shows up on SmackDown. You know how they like to kill names. Ridge Holland and Ricochet as well. And then they drafted criminally underused talent like Jeff Hardy, Drew Gulak, and Mace. I'm really hoping he doesn't have to keep going by Mace. I mean, out of all the names that Retribution got, Mace was probably the least cringeworthy. But Monday Night Raw hits each of these beats just a little bit harder. Top guys. They got Big E, currently the WWE Champion. We have WWE Hall of Famer Edge, and we have Seth Rollins. You still have, Raw has fresh young talent in Austin Theory and Olympian Gable Stevenson. They also have the criminally underused or poorly booked talent, such as Kevin Owens, Finn Balor, and Apollo Crews. Although, if you believe a rumor and innuendo, Kevin Owens may not be in the WWE for much longer. It's close, but Raw is going to get the edge because they have a good balance of immediate star power and a strong foundation of potential. Can the creative team do well with this potential? Probably not, but that's not entirely on the talent. So I'm going to officially say Raw wins the draft this year. Now we just have to wait until the 22nd of this month for it to officially take effect. Seriously though, what's up with that? Speaking of what's up with that, Hurricane Helms wants to know how the hell AEW Dynamite in Minneapolis, of all places, is outselling WWE Survivor Series. That's not all. Reports are indicating that AEW is also outselling WWE in the newly built UBS Arena featured in New York, with both shows having booked the arena within 1 week of one another. While it will be a long time before either company closes up shop, continuing trends like these could be not just an indicator of which fan base is larger, but of which of these two carry a better business model. AEW runs maybe one or two special non-televised house shows a year. With the recent addition to AEW Rampage, they are now doing two live televised shows a week. In comparison, WWE has Raw and SmackDown touring the world year-round, at least pre-COVID and hopefully coming soon post-COVID. I do believe they've started a European tour at the time of this recording, with NXT maintaining its home crowd of Floridians consistently. Both companies have been unafraid to book stadiums and arenas as they always believed they'd sell out. That's true for one company right now. Now there's a concern that in the future, WWE may have to display empty seats. I'm not saying they're going to display an empty arena, but they're not going to have that packed feeling that's so often associated with their shows. By comparison, independent promotions are running smaller crowd shows in Elks Lodges, community centers, and, when in warmer weather, hosting them outside. While independents can maintain a crowd with loyalty and consistently performing in that area, AEW is maintaining as a spectacle due to the reduced schedule. But before COVID, WWE almost never stopped putting on shows. At some points, talent would only be given 2 days off a week, and at some points, they wouldn't even be given Christmas Day off to be with their families. WWE has been coasting between loyal fans and being a spectacle for the places that they don't visit that often, such as my own home up here in New Hampshire. But with easy access to their events through Peacock, a reduced house show schedule, and lackluster shows resulting in a magnitude of negative feedback from their own fan base, WWE is selling tickets at a much slower rate than their main competitor. Now, I'll get back to how much money AEW is making in a moment, but I want to take a moment to look at recent happenings in the mixed martial arts world. We've seen a lot go down in the UFC, and throughout the years, there have been many rules implemented as well as the approval of state safety commissions. I'm going to look at the co-main event between Kevin Holland and Kyle Daukaus that took place on Fight Night, October 2nd. In the first round of this fight, there was a clearly accidental clash of heads between the competitors, though Kevin Holland seemed to receive the worst of it as he immediately dropped to the ground. In motion, the referee was ready to call a knockout blow, but when Daukaus moved in for the kill, Holland began fighting back, and referee Dan Mirgliotta allowed the fight to continue while motioning to the team at cage side that he wants the footage reviewed. The first round would not finish, as Daukaus would submit Holland to a rear naked choke. Holland was okay with how the situation went, but Dan had left the cage and was speaking with Herb Dean and other officials, both with the UFC and the Nevada State Athletic Commission. Dan was still mic'd up, and so the television audience as well as the ring cage side announcers could make out parts of the conversation. Dan stated that he knew it was accidental, so it shouldn't lead to a disqualification as would normally be the case, and it was clear they were either going to have to allow the result to remain or call it a no contest because the exchange that led to the finish was a result of this accidental headbutt. In the moment, I had stated that I believed the result should have remained because it was an accident. Some may have laid an asterisk next to the result, but Holland did show fight, and it was not an intentional illegal maneuver. However, Dan Mirgliotta declared a no contest, leaving both fighters disappointed. Kevin Holland could even be heard asking Kyle Daukaus and his team if they would be okay with scheduling a rematch, a way for both men to wipe the slate clean and metaphorically erase the no contest from their record. Current reports state that these men will have that rematch as early as November 13th, which would be the first fight night to take place after UFC 268. While I am happy that the UFC is taking steps to ensure the safety of the fighters, there are a few things I did not like. For one, I did not like that the Nevada State Athletic Commission felt the need to personally oversee this decision. There's clearly no precedent for this kind of situation, and they should have allowed Dan to handle the situation, especially seeing as he was using the tools provided, such as instant replay and counsel from a fellow trusted official. As I stated earlier, I don't agree with the decision either, as I believe Daukaus should have been given the win he had earned. It was not an intentional headbutt. He suffered damage as well, though not nearly to the degree Holland did. And Holland both showed fight and that he was willing to accept the result. And one more thing I dislike is how gun-shy officials became after this. With Dana White's contender series happening 3 days later, officials were calling timeouts in the fight at the slightest sign of a head collision, making sure to check with both fighters. While I'm sure these are orders from on high, the fighters were growing considerably frustrated at the interruption to the flow of action. While safety is important, the constant start and stop can also become a factor in how the fight plays out, for both fighters and in the judges' eyes. While I'm on Dana White's Contender Series, let me take the time to say that between that and The Ultimate Fighter, the UFC should trim the fat and allow the superior show to reign. The Ultimate Fighter is far superior, as it retains a favorite for MMA fans in tournament-style formatting. It helps to build a super fight between the coaches, and the fighters are in control of their own destiny. Meanwhile, on Dana White's Contender Series, we are stuck with Dana's bias. Two great fighters could have a technical clinic, making for a great showcase of mixed martial arts. That's mixed martial arts, guys. Not boxing, not kickboxing. Yes, there's going to be wrestling. Yes, there's going to be grappling submissions. You want to run a boxing promotion, Dana? Oh, that's right. You already tried that. Dana generally looks for finishers, and he'll pass on both men if it goes to a decision more often than not. Now, Dana will more often than not decline to explain what he's looking for in a specific fighter to improve on, such as, on the October 5th episode of Dana White's Contender Series, Joseph Holmes made for a terrific fight, earning a second round submission victory. Despite only one competitor outperforming him in my opinion, every single winner on the show, including one that was hospitalized, was awarded a contract. All except Holmes, who was instead invited to compete on a developmental promotions fight card instead. While dealing with Dana's bias is undoubtedly a part of the job, I enjoy seeing the fighters compete and learn under experienced professionals in actually taking their destiny into their own hands. Now, let's get back to AEW. I have a pretty big question to ask here. Does AEW need a salary cap? Now, most people associate salary caps with sports teams in major leagues like the NFL and the NBA, and these are usually used to help make sure that teams remain competitive. But in this case, I suggest that a salary cap might be more to keep AEW afloat long term. A lot of the resentment that has been building towards the WWE comes from because they have begun signing talent seemingly with the intention of retaining them. No creative plans or intention of using them. Simply keeping them from working for someone else. Then that resentment grew even larger after WWE seemingly couldn't book the talent consistently across the many hours of television and streaming they have access to. And it finally burst when, by their own admission, reportedly, they had to let talent go en masse due to budget cuts. Now, I can't say that AEW doesn't have the best of intentions when they hire all the talent that they have. I'm sure they do. But despite declaring that they only aimed to sign the best of the best 2 years ago, their roster now includes 90 men and 23 women. And that's not counting all of the independent talent they give airtime to on YouTube. AEW has 3 hours of television time on TNT, two of which are moving to TBS at the turn of the new year. More on that later. They're making a smart play by turning their top talent into spectacles, with Kenny Omega only working 21 matches for the company this year so far. But even with keeping those men and women off the air for an extended period, we are still finding issues with keeping originals on consistently, mainly due to the large influx of talent that they have been signing. Within the past month, they have announced the signings of CM Punk, Adam Cole, baby, Ruby Soho, Fuego del Sol, Bryan Danielson, and most recently, Bobby Fish. Meanwhile, we've seen Jungle Boy shine, but inconsistently, having received multiple title opportunities, but always playing the bridesmaid and never the bride. MJF, the greatest heel in modern wrestling, has never won a championship. His greatest testament to his time in AEW is having beaten Chris Jericho more than once and winning the Dynamite Diamond Ring twice in a row. Darby Allin is in danger of being overshadowed, and Sammy Guevara has only just now won the TNT title after a less than stellar run for Miro. A never signing post the WWE purge, mind you. These four men are being highlighted as the pillars of AEW. You can get that shirt at shopaew.com. And yet, because of TK's large supply of money, these young men have been lost in the shuffle, coming up for air whenever the crowd's interest in the next big thing begins to wane. Now, I'm not saying that AEW shouldn't be signing the amazing talent that's hitting the free market, but this is a look at how they are continuing a dangerous trend. Obvious answers aren't as simple as one may think, either. They could invest in more television time and more special weekend event cards. But then they lose the spectacle of their super shows and risk oversaturating their television audience. They could use their talent on their YouTube shows in place of all of the indie talent that they book, but then they risk stymieing the momentum of progression into the next generation of wrestling. Now, let's circle back into the salary cap idea. Say AEW is put on an even tighter leash for how much money they can spend on talent each year. They'd be in a position where they'd have to negotiate harder, which in turn would lead to them having to make harder decisions on what talent they are able to sign more immediately and when to use them. It'd be a return to the idea that they only sign the elite talent because they can only afford to spend their budget on the best. This idea could also extend to the possibility of trade options, which is already a viable option given their working relationships with Impact Wrestling, the NWA, New Japan, and AAA. Heck, throw in Ring of Honor and MLW and you have a 7-team league of professional wrestling, all with a feeder system of independent promotions acting as the NCAA. This started as a conversation of if AEW needs a leash, but now it's a conversation of what if the entire wrestling promotion came together in a competitive sense? Well, that is a far possibility and certainly decades from happening if it does in fact happen. One has to wonder, would it bring about the next great boom of professional wrestling? Or would it fail faster than the XFL in the beginning of Corona Mania? Alright guys, we're going to take a break from all the potential postulating of a future that will likely never come. Let's talk about what's coming to AEW in the immediate future. The TBS title. The women's division's own television title. First off, not a fan of the name. I was willing to forgive the naming of the TNT title because at least with their primary show being named Dynamite, there can be some synergy if their 5-year deal with Turner falls through. TBS, on the other hand, will forever be linked with Turner. So, perish the thought, if AEW did end up on a never television network, they'd be left in the position of rebranding the title or dropping it altogether. Naming aside, the belt does have a decent look. Retaining the logo of Dynamite's upcoming home with a dash of blue to go with the gold, it's striking and left an impression after seeing it unveiled. As far as contenders go, I understand AEW's desire to play some of their top talent in the opening tournament, just like they did with the TNT title. It especially works well to keep their top names out there, with them already putting Thunder Rosa, Jade Cargill, and Serena Deeb, among others, into the conversation. What I'd like to see come from this title is the same thing I'd like to see come from the TNT title, and that's for those titles to be a gateway to taking the next step. The NWA has the Lucky 7. Impact has Option C. Even WWE has a long list of men who have won the world title after having been Intercontinental Champion. If Thunder Rosa wins this title and has a successful, lengthy reign, after losing it, I want her to challenge for the women's world title. Just like I wish Darby Allin, Cody Rhodes, and Sammy Guevara would go on to become the world champions in their division. As far as who I see taking the gold at the end of this tournament, Jade Cargill is the brand, and Jade Cargill is that bitch. Oh shit, I think I have to pay them now since I used that. Oh well. She's exactly the kind of woman Turner executives would want as the face of their channel. And while Turner is far more accepting of individuals than most, at least that's what they display themselves to be, having a woman with the physique of Jade Cargill as the face of their premier athletic showcase will only do wonders for their audience and any potential new viewers they'll receive upon being moved to TBS. And while I am discussing top female talent, I'm going to close out today's episode with a look at Impact's recent supercard, the all-female-led Knockouts Knockdown. I was happy to see that Impact truly allowed all women to shine, both in athletic competition as well as in the roles of referee and commentary. Having veterans like Mickie James and Vida Scott on commentary kept the flow progressing at a digestible pace, and it was great to see Melissa Santos performing ring announcing duties again. The show opened with the opening round matches of the titular tournament, seeing Rachel Ellering defeat Lady Frost, Chelsea Green defeat Renee Michelle, Mercedes Martinez defeat Brandi Lauren, and Tasha Steelz defeat Jamie Senegal. The foundation for the finals were planted in these matches. Rachel Ellering visibly stole damage to her ribcage after defeating Lady Frost in a segment that was given roughly 15 minutes curtain to curtain. Similarly, Chelsea Green pulled off her victory, but not without suffering damage to her injured hand. Consequently, Mercedes and Tasha pulled off major victories with confidence and swagger. Mercedes in even more decisive fashion, defeating Brandi in only a little over 2 minutes. Taking these factors and the exchange Mercedes and Tasha had in the Impact tapings prior to this show, and you have yourselves a finals. But before we get to the semis, we are introduced to the first of two Pick Your Poison matches. In the build-up to Bound for Glory, where Deonna will defend her Knockouts title against Mickie James, on this night, Mickie got to select Deonna's opponent, and she selected Masha Slamovich. This Russian-born and Japanese-trained competitor put up quite a fight, but Deonna's submission artistry was on full display, managing to trap Masha and force her to verbally submit. When we get to the semifinals, Mercedes had a more difficult time with her second opponent, as Rachel managed to endure through the pain for over 10 minutes before Mercedes forced her to submit. Tasha, despite her size, refuses to be seen as an underdog and defeated Chelsea Green, maintaining her confidence and intensity from bell to bell. Easy to see how when listening to her banging entrance music, something that the Impact production teams continue to perform well in. For real though, guys, I want to hear that song like all the time. Someone get the. She's got a theme song on YouTube, but it's the old one. I want this new one. Even she can be seen on camera singing along to it because this is her anthem. This matches her character persona so well. I need to be able to put this on my iPhone, guys. After the announcement that the recently retired Awesome Kong is to be the next woman inducted into the Impact Wrestling Hall of Fame, Impact hosted a Fatal 4-Way Monsters Ball match in honor of Daphne. Savannah Evans, Alicia Edwards, Jordan Grace, and Kimberly all fought hard with some creative offense, with the inclusion of thumbtacks, weight plates, and of course Kendra, the barbed wire kendo stick. Savannah Evans took the victory, much to her partner Tasha Steelz's albeit brief approval. Tasha and Mercedes will go on to have what I'm sure will be lauded as one of the most underrated matches of the year. Two hard-hitting, proud, Boricuan women clashed and only one came out on top. While I would have been happy to see Tasha Steelz get the title shot and truly break out as a singles competitor, Mercedes Martinez is a top free agent, and Impact is smart to single her out as a singles competitor while her stock is rising. After Mercedes celebrated, and I lamented not getting to jam out to Steelz's theme, seriously though guys, someone update this on YouTube. Literally, like, if you find this on YouTube, the new one, not the first one, the 2021, now I want the 2021 one, and, like, just throw that link on the socials with, like, no explanation. I'll know. I'm basically doing every job right now. I'll see it. Much appreciated to all of you. Before this Monsters Ball match, actually it may have been after, they had a very nice commercial with multiple members of the wrestling community speaking out about mental health awareness in the professional wrestling industry. I feel like in the professional wrestling industry, mental health isn't always something that is looked at with a serious conversation. After the recent Dark Side of the Ring episode on Canyon, a man who took his own life, and with the very tragic events that led to Daphne's own suicide, they spoke out and they made sure to let everyone know that they are not alone. And that is something that's very important to me as a host, and I'm sure it is something very important to this entire studio as a company. So I'm going to take a break from talking about Knockouts Knockdown and join them in saying, you're not alone, guys. Remember that. All right. But now it's time for our main event. That's right. The tournament finals were not the main event. Strange move, but not when you consider that it was a title match. Rosemary and Jessica Havoc of the Decay defended their Knockouts tag team titles against Madison Rayne and Tennille Dashwood. I found this match rather lackluster, but the live crowd was very much into it, so perhaps there was just something I wasn't vibing with. Rayne and Tennille almost pulled off the victory after some interference from Caleb with a K, though the ref was distracted watching Crazy Steve and Black Tallroos chase Caleb off. After that interaction, Havoc and Rosemary work together to take the influential tag team down and walk away, still the tag team champions. Although, that may not be the case come Bound for Glory, the 23rd of this month, because as revealed at the end of the broadcast, the Inspiration, formerly known as the Iconics, start their comeback tour. You can listen to their antics on their podcast, Offer Chops. That's right, just search Offer Chops on whatever podcast platform you're listening to this on. They've got like 13 episodes out, and they are all hilarious. There's plenty to look forward to with that show. In addition to the Inspiration, we have Deonna Purrazzo defending the Knockouts title against Mickie James, and Christian Cage defending the Impact World title against Josh Alexander after Josh cashed in Option C. I'll likely be catching the replay as it's happening live on the West Coast, meaning it won't start until 10 p.m. for me. Instead, I might have to bide my time for that live Dynamite in Boston. Alright guys, we have talked multiple topics on women's wrestling, UFC regulations, and how maybe the wrestling industry can learn a bit from football. Good God, am I turning into a football guy? Oh my God. Though not too much, because everyone loves a good bounty in wrestling now and then. Next week, we're going back to covering gaming when I tell you guys about my experience and thoughts on Life is Strange, True Colors. Where is it match up compared to past titles? Who are some of the standout characters? And how will I feel about the moral implications of reading and possibly controlling people's emotions? Until then, hit up our socials. Look for Clark Dion on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And hit the support link in the episode description if you'd like to support my habits of traveling to wrestling shows, playing fun games, watching scary movies, and then sitting in front of this mic telling you all about it. I appreciate every single one of you to sit down and listen to me talk, guys. Let me know what topics you'd like me to cover in the future, because I'm hoping to keep going strong after we hit our one-year mark of production that's coming at the end of November. Much love, guys. Enjoy the rest of your day.